Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 181. It's Monday, September 26th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, COVID-19 seems to be kind of a mixed bag. We're going to be entering flu season here really soon. It looks like we've got a mild respite as hospitalizations and such have gone down, but there's still plenty of COVID around and deaths are still holding at a stubborn 400 plus deaths a day, which is pretty high, far more than what would I consider acceptable. And it's really stunning how the different variants, we have several brewing now that any one of them or several of them could take off and become the new and the latest. So let's start with a story about that. This from Fortune. Scientists were worried about a particular COVID variant this fall. They didn't expect its offspring. Omicron offspring BA2.75, dubbed Centaurus, seemed like the COVID variant to watch this summer, one with the potential to wreak unprecedented havoc later in the year. The World Health Organization announced in July it was tracking the concerning new variant, which had been identified in 10 countries, including the U.S., and was gaining ground against other transmissible strains of the virus, like BA5 in India. But Centaurus is no longer a worry, said Dr. Rajnarayanan, Assistant Dean of Research and Associate Professor at the New York Institute of Technology in Jonesboro, Arkansas. Instead, one of its children, BA2.75.2, has outcompeted it, eliminating it as a threat but replacing it with a more formidable one. It's one to watch this fall, he says, for more reasons than one. Among BA2.75.2's concerning traits, its spike protein binds to human cells tightly, better than any other variant so far. By doing so, it makes it much more difficult for antibodies to successfully attack. It's picking up mutations that make it more similar to BA5 the deadly Delta variant of late 2021. And it's just a couple of mutations away from picking up an increased transmission speed. To make matters worse, the new variant shows extensive escapability, according to a new preprint paper released last week by researchers at the Imperial College in London and the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. The paper has not yet been peer-reviewed, but has been widely cited by experts. The authors called the Centaurus spawn the most neutralization-resistant variant evaluated to date and said it may effectively evade antibody immunity built by vaccination and prior infection. The variant could even escape immunity provided by the last monoclonal antibody treatment effective in currently circulating variants. These are our last monoclonal antibodies. For the immunocompromised right now, having monoclonal antibodies is one of the best ways to mitigate infections, since vaccines don't work that well, as well in immunocompromised folks. If you take the tool away, it's going to be a problem. He encourages all Americans to get boosted, saying the new Omicron bivalent booster is the best tool society has against the virus. And more bad news also from Fortune. Just in time for fall, there's a brand new COVID variant making headway in the U.S. A new COVID strain started to create waves among virus trackers this last week, outpacing nearly all other variants of interest scientists are tracking in the U.S. this autumn. The Omicron spawn, which scientists have named BF.7, short for BA.5.2.1.7, comprised 1.7% of sequenced infections last week in the U.S., according to new data from the CDC. Other variants jockeying for the top spot right now, held by BA.5 at 85%, include BA.4.6, which comprised 10.3% of infections, and BA.2.75, which comprised 1.3%. Scientists are taking notice of BF.7 because it's making headway in an increasingly crowded field of Omicron subvariants. For months, they've watched the BA.2.75 dubbed Centaurus by the Twitterverse as a variant of interest with potential to surge this fall. But this week, BF.7 surpassed it. BF.7 is only beginning to grow off in the U.S., but it's already taken off in other countries. So far, Belgium has seen the lion's share of BF.7 cases identified globally, 25%. Denmark, Germany, and France have each seen 10% of the world's identified cases so far, according to COVIDlineages.org, a COVID data repository updated daily by contributors from universities in England, Scotland, Australia, and others. The new subvariant was first reported by the CDC as part of the cases of BA.5, which rose to prominence this summer. But the CDC recently broke it out into its own category when its cases topped 1%, Dr. Stuart Ray, Vice Chair of Medicine for Data Integrity and Analytics at Johns Hopkins Department of Medicine, said. The same growth of age in multiple countries makes it more reasonable to think that BF.7 is gaining a foothold, and it's particularly more transmissible than the parent BA.5, Ray said. Children of variants don't grow relative to their parent unless they have an advantage. COVID is continually evolving to become a more immune invasive, according to Ray, and Omicron is spawning exponentially. He added he wouldn't be surprised to see a new variant altogether this fall. It's been a while since we went from Alpha to Beta to Gamma to Delta, then to Omicron, Cromie said. We may be complacent. This may be feeding into the notion that this is behind us. The tangle of Omicron spawns, with or without a new parent variant, could make for a rough fall and winter, Ray said. His advice? Continue to mask and get your booster. And remember that the pandemic isn't over. Yikes. It's a little scary how quickly these variants and subvariants are just rolling out. And I wanted to just read a quote from an article that I'm going to cite at the end in my bonus articles, a New York Times article that's entitled Why Omicron Might Stick Around. It's likely that most of these variants got their mutations by going into hiding. Instead of jumping from one host to another, they create chronic infections in people with weakened immune systems, unable to mount a strong attack. These victims harbored the virus for months, allowing it to accumulate mutations. When it eventually emerged from its host, the virus had a startling range of new abilities, finding new ways to invade cells, weaken the immune system, and evade antibodies. When it gets out, it's like an invasive species. So a very common way that mutations happen is just sheer amount of replication. So the millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of infections we've had over the summer just in the U.S. can help spawn new variants. But the fact that we've lowered our guard and are making very vulnerable people, particularly immunocompromised people, more likely to get infected, that may in fact may be the biggest driver of these new variants. So we do pay a price for playing a little loosey-goosey and not protecting the most vulnerable in our society. Okay, well, one more quick story here on where our attitudes to COVID stand in the U.S. here today. Then I'll get to the local update. This from The Hill. Concerns about COVID exposure at work steady since last fall, says Gallup poll. A third of employed adults are concerned about exposure to COVID-19 at work, a figure that is relatively unchanged since last year, according to a new Gallup poll. The percentage has fallen, however, from the first 6 months of the pandemic in 2020. Roughly half of respondents were uneasy about exposure at work at the time, while the percentage of those saying they are not concerned at all has grown from 23% in 2020 to a record high of 39% in the latest polling. Okay, well, now to the Lucas County local COVID-19 update. Seems to be a mixed bag here. We've seen a significant drop in the number of reported cases and the testing positivity rates, which is good news. But we've actually seen a jump up in nursing home active cases and actually new hospitalizations in Lucas County has increased slowly over the last month. So this may be playing into the fact that some of the most damage that's being done by the epidemic is not the huge amount of infections that are happening out in the, quote, general population with a more average risk, but the fact that the virus is penetrating into more vulnerable populations and resulting in hospitalizations and deaths. So over the last 2 weeks, we did drop the average daily number of cases identified in Lucas County down to 73 a day from 127. That's good news. And the testing positivity rate in Lucas County has dropped to around 12% from 18% a couple weeks ago. And that's getting in line a little with Ohio, which is also around 12%, a little higher than the U.S., which is around 10%. And each of those dropping in all areas, locally in Ohio and the U.S. So that's good news. But as I referenced, the in Lucas County nursing homes, the long-term care facilities, over the last 2 weeks, we jumped up from 64 active cases to 92. And we did have another death from COVID of folks in long-term care facilities in Lucas County. Okay, so hospitalizations and ICU patients in the U.S. are continuing a slow decline, although Ohio hospitalizations have remained fairly steady. And as seeming to be the reversal of fortune over the last month or so, new hospital admissions in Lucas County has been increasing slowly, even though total cases identified has gone down. And nationally, deaths are at a stubborn level of about 430 a day. As a reminder of what you can do, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department is offering free walk-in booster clinics Monday through Friday. Take advantage of it if you can. Okay, well, as COVID continues to recede as a salient issue in the minds of Americans, we see that COVID data seems to get thinner and thinner. It's a little harder to make, for instance, the local COVID report because the data kind of gets weaker and weaker. But a couple stories that get at how important data tracking is, and which is a core function of public health, is basic assessment of the community's health. We have this article from Reason. Senate investigation finds Justice Department undercounted prison and jail deaths last year by nearly 1,000. The Justice Department's annual tally of deaths in state prisons and jails was short by nearly 1,000 last year, an investigation by the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations found. So I just have a comment here in the middle. You know, measuring somebody, whether they're alive or dead, is actually not that hard to do. The fact that this is not done well just shows how weak of a data infrastructure and public health infrastructure we have in particular areas. And of course, with particularly vulnerable populations, which often line up with populations that we don't care much about, which of course is people that are incarcerated. Okay, back to the story. States are required under the Death in Custody Reporting Act to submit data on deaths in prisons and jails to the Justice Department. But in a report release, the committee says that the Justice Department has failed to effectively implement the law, undermining the accuracy of its data and congressional oversight of deaths in custody. The committee and the Government Accountability Office found that in the last year alone, the department missed 990 prison and jail deaths that were reported on state websites, news articles, and other public databases. These failures have, quote, deprived Congress and the American public of information about who is dying in custody and why, the report says. This information is critical to improve transparency in prisons and jails, identifying trends in custodial deaths that may warrant corrective action, such as failure to provide adequate medical care, mental health services, or safeguard prisoners from violence, and identifying specific facilities with outlying death rates. DOJ's failure to implement this law and to continue to voluntarily publish this information is a missed opportunity to prevent avoidable deaths. Despite the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment and excessive force, incarcerated people in prison systems and jails across the U.S. are regularly subjected to medical neglect, brutality, and unsafe living conditions. Federal judges in both Arizona and Illinois recently held those state prison systems in contempt for failing to address gruesome medical neglect within their walls. The Justice Department has in recent years found unconstitutional conditions in prisons in Florida and Alabama, and it is investigating similar allegations in Mississippi and Georgia. In New York City, the infamous Rikers Island jail complex is under threat of being put in receivership by a federal judge because of a string of preventable deaths and chronic corruption. And in some similar news about underreporting and poor data collection, this from the Military Times, veteran suicide rate may be double federal estimates, study suggests. The rate of suicide among veterans may be more than double what federal officials report annually because of undercounting related to drug overdose deaths and service record errors, according to a new analysis. Officials from America's Warrior Partnership, in a joint study with the University of Alabama and Duke University, reviewed census death data from 2014 to 2018 for 8 states and found thousands of cases of suspected or confirmed suicides not included in federal calculations. If those figures were to be repeated across other states, it would push the veteran suicide rate from about 17 individuals a day, the official estimate released by the Department of Veterans Affairs last year, up to 44 veterans a day. So that's more than doubling, from 17 a day to 44 a day. The largest category of overlooked deaths, about 60% of the uncounted cases by the report's estimate, concerned drug overdoses. In the states the researchers reviewed, many drug deaths were classified as accidents or unknown intent, even though indications were that the fatalities should be grouped alongside suicides. Whether it's an accident or a suicide doesn't really matter. The point is these are preventable, so that means we can address them. Researchers also found numerous cases where deceased individuals' military history was incorrectly reported, either by coroners or family members. More often, those mistakes led to undercounting the number of veterans' deaths. To solve that issue, the group is pushing for more federal tools to access Defense Department records in an effort to confirm an individual's veteran status. Okay, well now I want to change gears and move to a block of stories largely about healthcare. First up from MedPage Today, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force to recommend anxiety and depression screening. After pandemic years that brought mental health to the fore, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is proposing to recommend screening adults for anxiety and depression, with one exception. In the group's draft recommendations, screening to identify depression got a B-grade go-ahead for all adults without signs or symptoms, including during pregnancy and postpartum periods. Anxiety screening got the same recommendation but excluded seniors. For those 65 and older, the task force issued an I statement due to insufficient evidence. Just when to screen and how often wasn't clear, the task force noted. A pragmatic approach in the absence of data might include screening all adults who have not been screened previously and using clinical judgment in consideration of risk factors, comorbid conditions, and life events to determine if additional screening of high-risk patients is warranted. A draft I statement was also issued for suicide screening. Tragically, while suicide is a leading cause of death among adults, there is not enough evidence on whether screening people without signs or symptoms will ultimately help prevent suicide. More research is critically needed on the role of screening in suicide prevention. Underdetection and undertreatment of anxiety disorders appears common, the draft statement noted. This may be because patients with anxiety disorders present with other complaints, such as sleep disturbances or somatic complaints. The draft statement cited a study showing anxiety as the chief complaint for only 13% of primary care patients with generalized anxiety disorder, whereas the presentation for somatic complaints were 48% for pain. For somatic complaints were 48%, pain at 35%, and sleep disturbances for 33%. Depression has been on the rise, reaching a prevalence of nearly 1 in 10 adults in 2020, according to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, recently published in the American Journal of Public Health. However, there has been no commensurate increase in treatment. Decisive action involving a multi-pronged public health campaign that includes evidence-based prevention and intervention to address this ongoing mental health crisis is urgently needed, the authors of the paper concluded. COVID-19 worsened the situation, spiking the major depressive disorder prevalence by 28% and anxiety disorder prevalence by 26% globally, as estimated by one systematic review in The Lancet. This rise appears to have persisted into at least 2021 in the U.S., according to a nationally representative study. Data on anxiety disorder prevalence was suggested that rates are lowest in 65 to 79-year-olds, but the task force noted these data are outdated. The recommendations could have a large impact, it commented Stuart Shankman, chief of psychology at Northwestern University School of Medicine in Chicago. The task force draft recommendation increases attention to mental health for primary care providers because it would make it part of a patient's regular assessment. As most healthcare is done through primary care, this increases the chance that mental health needs will be met. While the 2008 Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act mandated equal coverage of mental health benefits by health insurers, it hasn't gone so well. The Community Preventive Services Task Force recommends mental health benefits legislation in increasing appropriate utilization of mental health services for people with mental health conditions, as the anxiety screening draft document had pointed out. The draft recommendations would apply only to people with no signs or symptoms of depression or anxiety. Anyone who has concerns or is showing signs of depression, anxiety, or suicidal ideation should be connected to the appropriate care. And moving to health and pregnancy, this from Medical Express. Most pregnancy-related deaths in U.S. are avoidable, says CDC. 4 out of 5 pregnancy-related deaths in the United States could be avoided, a new report by the nation's top public health agency says, as mothers in the country face a comparatively high mortality rate, especially among Black women. Some 22% of deaths occurred during pregnancy, 25% on the day of delivery or in the following week, and 53% up to a year later. The leading cause identified in 23% of cases was mental health problems, including suicide or drug overdoses, followed by hemorrhage, bleeding, 14%, and heart problems, 13%. Pregnancy and its consequences can, for example, aggravate a mental illness, make access to psychiatric treatment difficult, or even cause pain leading to substance abuse or self-harm. Among the measures recommended to address the problem were furthering access to health insurance, improving pre- and postnatal care, as well as better transportation options to be able to access care. The maternal death rate has been increasing in the United States for years and ranks as one of the worst among industrialized nations. In 2020, it stood at 24 per 100,000 births, according to data published in February. But underneath that figure lie stark inequalities. The death rate per 100,000 births was 55 among Black mothers versus 19 for white mothers. And to drive that home, this from The Hill. America is the most dangerous place to give birth in the developed world. It's only getting worse. Earlier this month, the Texas Department of State Health Services missed the deadline to publish the 2019 data on maternal mortality rates in the state, announcing instead that this data will be made available only in mid-2023. What may seem like a piece of administrative incompetence could instead be an attempt to hide a damning state and nationwide statistic from public view until after the 2022 midterms. Maternal mortality rate is defined as the number of mothers dying during childbirth or because of other pregnancy-related causes. Typically expressed in numbers of such deaths per 100,000 live births, the maternal mortality rate is a measure of the country's development and the ability of its citizens to access health care. Indirectly, it also measures gender equality. Fathers do not die in childbirth, and a goal of an equitable society should be to eliminate this risk for mothers as well. Caring for expectant mothers costs money, and richer countries understandably have lower maternal mortality rates. According to 2017 data, Norway and Italy recorded just 2 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births. Sweden and Spain had 4, Japan 5, France and Singapore 8. The U.S. in contrast stood at 19 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births, on par with the poorest European country, Moldova, and faring a bit worse than Russia or Iran. America is the most dangerous place to give birth in the developed world. It is getting worse. A report by the World Health Organization found that all world regions experienced significant drops in the maternal mortality rate between 2000 and 2017. The European rate went down by 53%, Sub-Saharan Africa improved by 38%, Latin America by 23%, and the global average decreased by 38%. The only region that saw a sharp rise is North America, whose maternal mortality increased by 52%. Don't blame Canada. Their maternal mortality rate stayed roughly the same during the past 2 decades. Breaking down the U.S. data by race or by state reveals an even more abysmal situation. For non-Black Hispanic women, maternal mortality rate is a whopping 55 deaths per 100,000 live births, worse than, for example, Jordan or Panama. Louisiana, Indiana, and Georgia all recorded more than 40 deaths per 100,000 live births between 2011 and 2015. The last time Texas reported its numbers, the deaths stood at 35 deaths per 100,000 live births. These numbers are really, really bad. Texas is on par with Syria. Indiana is comparable to El Salvador. Louisiana is as bad as Kyrgyzstan. For a Black woman in Louisiana, chances of dying of pregnancy-related causes are the same as in Libya. But it will get even worse. 13 states banned essentially all forms of abortion, and 10 more are considering similar moves. many of these states are already have the highest maternal mortality rates in the U.S., and they will get higher still. Banning abortions does not eliminate them. It simply pushes them underground where they will be unsafe, leading to further deaths. Even the rare legal exceptions to anti-abortion statutes will have negative consequences on maternal mortality. While new laws still allow legal abortions when a mother's life is at risk, they simultaneously threaten providers with draconian punishments in all other cases. The fear of making such a costly mistake will make many healthcare providers understandably reluctant to intervene except in the most clear-cut cases. More deaths will ensue. The Supreme Court's recent reversal of Roe v. Wade was a big political win for the religious right, aligning the U.S., or at least half of it, with other highly religious countries where abortion is banned, such as Malta or Poland. But Malta and Poland follow the Christian logic in caring for their mothers, with some of the lowest maternal mortality rates in the world. The countries have just 6 and 2 deaths per 100,000 live births, respectively. Texas and other red states should perhaps do the same, rather than hide the data on maternal mortality. You are listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life, just for the health of it. Next up, from NBC News, gaming of U.S. patent system is keeping drug prices sky high, report says. 4 pharmaceutical companies have filed hundreds of patents to keep their drugs out of the hands of generic competition and prolong their unprecedented profits, according to a report published last Thursday. The excessive use of the patent system by drug makers Bristol-Myers Squibb, AbbVie, Regeneron, and Bayer keep the prices of medications at exorbitant levels, often at the expense of American consumers, according to a report from the Initiative for Medicines, Access, and Knowledge, or IMAC, a nonprofit organization that advocates drug patent reform. They get the power, they get the monopoly, and they start hiking their prices, said Priti Krishtel, a health justice lawyer and co-founder of IMAC. The U.S. patent system is meant to reward innovation by permitting drug companies to sell new medications on the market and barring other manufacturers from making generic versions for a set period of time, usually 20 years. Once the patent expires, generics are allowed on the market, often at a much lower price than the brand name drug. But drug makers often extend their patents by making small tweaks to the drugs, sustaining their monopolies for years. Legal experts refer to the tactic as evergreening, said Stanford University law professor Mark Lemley, who was not involved in the IMAC report. It's an approach seen across the pharmaceutical industry. Drug companies file, on average, more than 140 patent applications per drug, according to the IMAC report. Out of those patent applications, 66% of them were filed after the FDA approved the drug to be on the market. These extra patents are absolutely to extend their monopoly, said Arthur Kaplan, the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. While the practice of evergreening isn't necessarily illegal, said Kaplan, who was also not involved in the report, it is unethical. It's clear that the system is being manipulated and we need to be rethinking the rules of patenting. Tahir Amin, an intellectual property researcher and co-founder of IMAC, put it bluntly, companies are gaming the system. Because of this, advocates say reforming the patent system is an important next step in the nation's efforts to curb sky-high drug prices. Last month, President Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act into law, which lowers prescription drugs for patients on Medicare, but leaves out millions of Americans on private insurance and the uninsured. The practice of extending patents doesn't always go unchallenged. In some cases, generic manufacturers sue the drug makers to get their drugs on the market, Lemley said. However, he added, these lawsuits often end in settlements between the companies. Settling the lawsuit is, quote, essentially paying the generic to go away, Lemley said. The settlements are anti-competitive, Kaplan said, because the drug makers are paying to eliminate competition. And guess who loses out? You and me. Okay, well, next up, a really interesting story about structural racism in hospital care in the U.S., hospital financing in black and white. During our training as doctors, we have rotated through safety net hospitals, elite academic medical centers, and private clinics. The resources for patient care and comfort were sumptuous in some facilities, Spartan in others. The differences were often night and day, or, as we quantified in later analysis, black and white. We cared for far more white patients at highly resourced facilities, and many more black patients and other patients of color at those with fewer resources. While the 1964 Civil Rights Act forbade hospitals from discrimination based on race, segregation persists. According to Medicare data, we analyzed a relative handful of hospitals. Just 10% of all hospitals provide 3/4 of all care for black people covered by Medicare. We found that in hospital care, as in public education, separate usually means unequal. The hospitals in which black people account for the larger share of inpatients have relatively meager facilities, as measured by the dollar value of the buildings and equipment, and are much likely than other hospitals to offer expensive, high-tech, and often life-saving services like cardiac catheterization labs, or even routine ones like cardiac rehab programs. The term structural racism seems particularly apt for these systematic inequalities in hospitals' bricks, mortar, and equipment. Race-based inequities in hospital resources are the legacy of slavery, discrimination, and healthcare financing policies that directed resources to white communities and away from communities of color. The current-day hospital payment system continues to cement these inequities by assigning different dollar values to the care of different patients. Lower values for care delivered to people who are uninsured or covered by Medicare, and higher values to care for the privately insured and patients with Medicare, especially those able to pay deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurance. Black people are more likely to be consigned to the lower value group. Far more black people are uninsured or rely on Medicaid than white people, and black workers are less likely than white workers to have job-based private insurance. Fewer privately insured black families have the financial assets needed to cover the often substantial out-of-pocket costs of an insured hospital stay. This payment structure incentivizes hospital leaders to favor services and outreach efforts to attract lucrative and predominantly white patients. We use audited financial data that hospitals report to Medicare to quantify the financial disadvantage that hospitals incur by serving black communities. Hospitals caring for large shares of black patients were paid $283 less for each day of a patient's hospital stay compared to other hospitals. As a result, while many hospitals realized profits from their inpatient care, black serving facilities ran in the red. The difference in fundings were not attributable to differences in how sick the patients were, the complexity of care the hospitals delivered, or hospital characteristics like their size, location, or whether they were academic centers. Equalizing funding would have required $14 billion in additional payments to black-serving hospitals in 2018, which is the most recent year for which data were available, or about $25 million per black-serving hospital. Our analysis confirmed our on-the-ground observations. Hospitals serving black people must make do with fewer financial resources than other hospitals. That the U.S. hospital system values different patients differently and hence penalizes black-serving hospitals is a policy choice, and an unusual one among wealthy nations. In most other wealthy nations, even those like Germany with hundreds of different insurance plans, a single fee schedule applies to all patients. In the U.S., the second-class status of those covered by Medicaid was baked in at the outset, when, in the midst of the Civil Rights era, Congress chose to separate coverage for the poor, many of whom were black, from that from the elderly, most of whom were white. Medicare offered seniors a federal plan modeled on Blue Cross coverage, while Medicaid passed simultaneously, relegated the poor to a welfare-based program largely controlled, even today, by state governments, some of them explicitly racist. That the current hospital financing system assigns a lower dollar value to the care and lives of black patients is a largely hidden but pernicious form of structural racism. Health reform should equalize payments among patients and hospitals, and repair the damage of past policies by directing investments to resource-starved facilities that have long served black communities. Amen. Make it so. And in another story about the vagaries and sometimes roller coaster of federal health benefits, this from Medical Express, Medicaid enrollment soared by 25% during the COVID-19 pandemic, but a big decline could happen soon. Medicaid, the government-funded U.S. health insurer for people with low incomes, grew by about 25% between February of 2020 and May 2022, as policies adopted at the outset of the COVID-19 pandemic expanded the program's reach. All told, the number of people enrolled in Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, which serves kids and families with low to moderate incomes, increased from 71 million to 89 million. That's roughly 27% of all Americans. The pandemic-related increase in Medicaid enrollment was slightly larger than the 25% increase seen after the Affordable Care Act expanded Medicaid for adults starting in 2014. But unlike Medicaid expansion under the ACA, these pandemic policies are temporary. they will end once the federal government's COVID-19 public health emergency expires. Some experts predict Medicaid enrollment could fall by as many as 15 million people when this happens, disrupting health care for many Americans. In March 2020, Congress passed the first of several large spending packages called the Families First Coronavirus Response Act to help states shoulder increased Medicaid costs associated with the pandemic. That measure increased the share of Medicaid spending the federal government pays for by 6.2 percentage points in all states. This aid has made a big difference for states, which split the cost of Medicaid with the federal government. Before the pandemic, the federal government was paying about 65% of Medicaid's costs overall, with the precise share varying based on the state's average income. States picked up the other 35% of Medicaid costs. These costs accounted for more than one-fourth of states' budgets before the pandemic. The extra federal money for Medicaid came with an important requirement. States accepting funds could not remove anyone from Medicaid who was enrolled as of March 2020 or gained Medicaid afterwards, as long as the official public health emergency, first declared on January 31, 2020, remained in effect. This also applied for the Children's Health Insurance Program. All 50 states in the District of Columbia accepted the higher federal payments in exchange for keeping Medicaid enrollment stable during the pandemic. These changes helped to address long-standing instability in Medicaid coverage for many people. Before the pandemic, nearly 25% of those with Medicaid would enter or exit the program each year as their short-term circumstances changed. People would lose Medicaid coverage when their income ticked up, their family circumstances changed, they aged out of the Children's Health Insurance Program, or they failed to complete required paperwork. Losing Medicaid coverage can lead to someone ending up without any health insurance at all, which increases the likelihood they will postpone or never get needed care. Having the same people frequently entering and exiting the program also increases the program's administrative costs over time. Even with many aspects of daily life getting back to normal, and President Joe Biden's comments to the media about the pandemic being, quote, over, the official public health emergency that spurred Medicaid enrollment growth still remains in force. When the government renewed the declaration for the 10th time in July 2022, it set a new expiration date of October 13th. The administration also said it would provide states with 60 days notice before it would end the federal emergency declaration, which suggests the declaration will be renewed at least one more time. When the emergency ends, states will have to reevaluate eligibility for everyone with Medicaid within 12 months. Extra federal funding for states will also end. These changes will have profound consequences. Millions of people will have to reestablish their eligibility for Medicaid and are at risk of losing coverage if they do not complete the required paperwork in time. The administration may ultimately decide to renew the COVID-19 emergency declaration again, as hundreds of Americans are still dying daily from the disease. Keeping it in place would prevent a massive drop in Medicaid enrollment and make it easier to continue other COVID-19 public health policies, such as making free COVID-19 testing and vaccinations widely available. Yep, we definitely need a unified system. I would say a single-payer national health program. Healthcare for all. Everyone in, nobody out. Same status, not these multiple tiers. And, of course, our healthcare system affects more than just those who are patients. This from MedPage Today. Physician burnout continues at record levels. One-third feel hopeless. The state of physician well-being remained low 2 years into the pandemic, survey data showed. One in three physicians reported feeling hopeless or that they had no purpose, according to the second part of the 2022 Survey of American Physicians from the nonprofit Physicians Foundation. For the second year in a row, 60% of over 1,500 physicians who completed the online survey said they often feel burned out, compared with 40% before the pandemic. Burnout remains at record levels despite the worst parts of the pandemic being behind us, Gary Price, president of the Physicians Foundation, said. Physician burnout has not gone unnoticed by our profession or by society, and yet we found most equally concerning is that there's still rampant stigma surrounding mental health care and that underlying system barriers are preventing physicians from accessing mental health care, Price observed. The share of physicians with self-harm thoughts grew from 7% in 2021 to 11% in 2022, the study found. Overall, 19% sought medical attention for a mental health problem, up from 14% in 2021. We knew stigmatizing and intrusive mental health questions on medical licensure and hospital credentialing applications was a barrier, but the survey reinforced how bad it is. Nearly 4 in 10 physicians were either afraid or knew another physician fearful of seeking mental health care because of questions asked in medical licensure, credentialing, or insurance applications. In all, 80% reported stigma surrounding mental health and mental health care seeking by physicians. About 2 in 10 physicians found their hospital or health system to be very or somewhat helpful in their mental health and well-being over the past year. 4 in 10 physicians saw their medical practice or group as very or somewhat helpful. By contrast, a majority of physicians rated family, 85%, friends, 81%, and colleagues, 62%, as helpful to their mental health and well-being. Price highlighted evidence-based actions from the nonprofit All In Coalition that could be initiated within 3 months to help physicians and other healthcare workers. Peer support programs and mental health counseling were among those actions. In the Physicians Foundation survey, 65% of respondents reported that confidential therapy and counseling or phone support was very or somewhat helpful, and 57% said they felt the same about peer support groups. More than half of physicians said their workplace rarely or never implemented a majority of evidence-based actions intended to support physicians, such as removing low-value work, giving physicians more flexibility and autonomy to improve the patient experience, and eliminating insurance approvals. Patients would like that one, too. Okay, well, the private equity business and venture capital continues to distort healthcare, making it a profit-driven enterprise more so than health-producing. This from Kaiser Health News. Death is anything but a dying business as private equity cashes in. Private equity firms are investing in healthcare from cradle to grave, and in the latter category, quite literally. A small but growing percentage of the funeral home industry and the broader death care market is being gobbled up by private equity-backed firms, attracted by high profit margins, predictable income, and the eventual deaths of tens of millions of baby boomers. The funeral home industry is in many ways a prime target for private equity, which looks for markets that are highly fragmented and could benefit from consolidation. By cobbling together chains of funeral homes, these firms can leverage economies of scale in purchasing, improve marketing strategies, and share administrative functions. According to industry officials, about 19,000 funeral homes make up the $23 billion industry in the U.S., at least 80% of which remain privately owned and operated, mostly mom-and-pop businesses, with a few regional chains thrown in. The remaining 20%, or about 3,800 homes, are owned by funeral home chains, and private equity-backed firms own about 1,000 of those. Consumer advocates worry that private equity firms will follow the lead of publicly traded companies that have built large chains of funeral homes and raised prices for consumers. The real master that's being served is not the grieving family who's paying the bill, it's the shareholder, said Joshua Slocum, executive director of the Funeral Consumers Alliance, a nonprofit that seeks to educate consumers about funeral costs and services. Although funeral price data is not readily available to the public, surveys by the local affiliates of the alliance have found that when publicly traded or private equity-backed chains acquire individual funeral homes, price hikes tend to follow. Meanwhile, many funeral home owner-operators are reaching a retirement age and have no one in the family willing to take over. A 2021 survey by the National Funeral Directors Association found that 27% of owners plan to sell their business or retire within 5 years. The desire to sell, combined with the investment money pouring into the field, has driven prices for funeral homes to new heights. Before private equity turned its eye to funeral homes, they were selling for 3 to 5 times their annual revenue. Now I'm hearing 7 to 9, said Barbara Chemis, executive director of the Cremation Association of North America, a trade group for the cremation industry. The value in funeral homes lies in more than their brick-and-mortar assets. Funeral home directors are often integral parts of their communities and have established significant goodwill with their neighbors. So, when corporate chains acquire these homes, they rarely change the name and often keep the former owners around to smooth the transition. Victoria Hainman, a Creighton University School of Law professor who studies the funeral home industry, worries the new corporate ownership might be devastating for grieving families. They're not behaving like normal, rational consumers, she said. They're not bargain shopping because death is viewed as an inappropriate time to bargain shop. For most families, a funeral will be one of the largest expenses they ever incur, but they often enter the shopping process cognitively impaired by grief and unsure of what is customary or appropriate. Only 1 in 5 consumers visit more than one funeral home to obtain a price list, according to a 2020 survey commissioned by the Consumer Federation of America. The online comparisons are virtually impossible. A study by the Federation for the Funeral Consumers Alliance found that just 18% of the funeral homes they sampled listed their prices on their website. As a result, families generally lean heavily on the expertise of a single funeral director who has a motive to sell them the most expensive options. so consumers can be pushed into buying packages for open casket funerals that include embalming and other services that drive up the cost and may be unnecessary. Okay, well, let's switch some gears and move to some nutrition and health stories, a couple here. This first one from Medical Express. Globally, diets are not much healthier today than they were 30 years ago. On a scale from 0 to 100 of how well people stick to recommended diets, with 0 being a poor diet, think heavy consumption of sugar and processed meats, and 100 representing the recommended balance of fruits, vegetables, legumes and nuts, and whole grains, most countries would earn a score of around 40.3. Globally, this represents a small but meaningful 1.5 point gain between 1990 and 2018. Researchers from the School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University reported in the journal Nature Food. The world's highest scoring countries were Vietnam, Iran, Indonesia, and India, and the lowest scoring countries were Brazil, Mexico, the United States, and Egypt. What more can I say? United States dragging the bottom in diet quality. And next up, while hunger persists in the world's most wealthiest nation, this from The Hill. Hunger was once a bipartisan issue. Will it ever be again? Nearly 50 years ago, President Richard Nixon organized the first White House conference on food, nutrition, and health, where he called on Congress to take action to address America's hunger crisis. It kickstarted a national conversation to address the growing problem of food insecurity across the nation. Many of the programs Nixon supported are still being implemented in some form today. The Biden administration is preparing to host a similar forum later this month, the first presidential-led initiative of its kind in nearly half a century to solve this continuing problem. Yet today, we lack the same bipartisan commitment Nixon showed to make this moment count for millions of underserved Americans who face every day without enough food to eat. Unless our elected leaders express a sudden and unexpected desire to work together, Biden's commendable objective of ending U.S. hunger by 2030 faces enormous challenges in both the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. Nixon was determined to stop hunger in America. In 1969, he urged Congress to pass food assistance initiatives, expand food stamps, improve food access to pregnant women and children, and streamline the way food programs were administered. He believed in it so deeply that he backed a plan to allocate $2.5 billion, and that's in 1969 dollars, to fight it, and proposed creating a new government agency to oversee it. That hunger and malnutrition should persist in our land, such as ours, is embarrassing and intolerable, Nixon said to lawmakers at the time. The moment is at hand to put an end to hunger in America itself, for all time. I ask of this Congress that has splendidly demonstrated its own disposition to act. Congressional leaders heeded Nixon's call by working collaboratively with his administration to establish new benefit standards for food stamp eligibility. Food stamp initiatives grew 5 times during Nixon's tenure in office and helped millions of people. Bipartisan support to combat hunger continued under George W. Bush, who helped restore food stamp access for America's immigrant population. Since then, additional improvements have been made to what we now call the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, to help the underprivileged. Despite these efforts, the number of people in America who go hungry or lack access to food every day is disheartening. The pandemic caused an astonishing 54 million people to be food insecure, and the racial disparity of COVID-19's impact was stark, affecting households of color twice as hard as white households. Pandemic relief efforts made an enormous difference in 2021 by reducing hunger to the lowest level on record in nearly 2 decades for families with children. But the expiration of the child tax credit, the discontinuation of the COVID-19 economic stimulus, and the skyrocketing cost of groceries due to inflation will likely cause a rebound in food insecurity across the country over the coming years. Biden's reversal of a Trump-era decision to defund SNAP brought back $1 billion per month of emergency relief to needy families. It was an important step, but it won't be enough to solve the hunger problems. SNAP is just one piece of the puzzle, helping more than 42 million people annually, which, combined with the school lunch program, lifted 3 million more people out of poverty in 2020. While overall child poverty statistics have declined in America, the threshold by which we measure the poverty line remains incomprehensibly low, $26,500 for a family of 4 in 2021. Anti-poverty advocates at the Shared Humanity Project say this grossly underestimates the number of people across the country who are struggling to make ends meet. Solving hunger demands more resources if the country is truly committed to ending the problem once and for all. The collaboration that's connecting the unconnected Democrats' Trump is evil mantra won't work this November. This year marked the 20th anniversary of the George McGovern Robert Dole Food for Education and Child Nutrition Program. Both men from opposing political parties dared to work together and put the needs of America's most marginalized community before their own political desires. The idea that lawmakers might put their differences aside so that millions have enough to eat food sounds preposterous in light of how politically divided we are today. But we must, for the health of millions of people, refuse to accept this challenge as something that cannot be overcome. Ending hunger in America is within our reach. Statistics from 2021 prove it can be done. The only thing standing in our way is an expression of political will from both sides to get it done. Let's make it happen. Okay, well, I wanted to end today's episode's reporting on a little bit better news. This from Politico. Senate approves first climate treaty in decades. The Senate ratified its first international climate treaty in 3 decades last Wednesday, approving an agreement worked out in 2016 that will phase down refrigerant chemicals that are among the most potent climate pollutants. While the Senate is badly divided on most climate issues, strong backing from the business community to eliminate hydrofluorocarbons, known as HFCs, aligned with environmentalist agenda to help secure enough Republican support to meet the Constitution's requirement of 2/3 support. The Senate voted 69-27 to approve the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol, joining 136 other nations in the European Union in approving the deal. Originally approved in the 1980s, the landmark Montreal Protocol successfully brought down emissions of chemicals that harmed the ozone layer, but in turn prompted manufacturers to switch to a new family of chemicals, hydrofluorocarbons, that do not harm the ozone layer but are potent greenhouse gases. Today, HFCs are used in refrigerators and air conditioners, as well as foam and aerosol products. Depending on its makeup, a pound of HFCs can have as much warming potential as hundreds or even tens of thousands of pounds of carbon dioxide. That makes capping their use a critical part of combating near-term warming. The Kigali Amendment will stave off a half degree Celsius of warming this century, according to the Biden administration. Good news. Okay, we're going to close with a regular feature of bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list. We have 18 stories today. 1, why Omicron might stick around, which I referenced at the beginning of the show. 2, very harmful lack of data blunts U.S. response to outbreaks. Another story of poor public health infrastructure. 3, polio is exploiting a very human weakness. The world has been so close to eradicating polio for so long, which is exactly why the virus is staging a comeback now. So, you don't spike the ball on the 2-yard line. 4, the White House has a major chance to improve coordination of federal nutrition efforts, now spanning 200 programs across 21 federal agencies. So that's a call to action to this week's White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health. 5, related to that, nutritional education is healthcare. Let's make it official. So, nutrition education in healthcare is almost non-existent, and the training of most healthcare providers who are expected to talk to people about nutrition is basically no better than plucking the average person off the street. So, need to up our game there. Article 6, the clock is ticking for UN goals to end poverty, and it doesn't look promising. And related to that, 7, extreme hunger on the rise in the world's worst climate hotspots. So, unfortunately, those that are least responsible for creating a crisis are the ones experiencing the greatest burden, and that one of those burdens is extreme hunger. Okay, number 8 is a follow-up to a story I did before in earlier weeks, I don't know, a couple months ago. Judge lifts U.S. ban on Mexicans entering country to sell blood plasma. Mexicans with short-term visas have comprised up to 10% of all plasma collected in the U.S. You be the judge of whether siphoning the lifeblood off of non-U.S. citizens is in fact a good thing or a bad thing. Story number 9. Private equity sees the billions in eye care as firms target high-profit procedures. And 10, sort of a follow-up to what I did about private equity in funeral homes, one you can use personally, how to avoid being overcharged for a funeral. Article 11, Surgery needs a new pay model, free from incentives to do more procedures. Our for-profit incentives often work contrary to what the best health practice is. Sometimes we do more expensive, not medically necessary procedures just because they make more money. 12. Is the Department of Justice underusing authority to hold pharma device execs accountable? Billions in fines, but only 13 corporate officials prosecuted for illegal behavior since 2000. And in more government oversight news, 13, FDA and USDA need to get on board with the CDC about reducing antibiotic use and raising animals for food. We may be facing a world without effective antibiotics in our lifetime. Need to do something about it now. 14. Mental health is political, as social determinants more critical than medical care. This is a good example of, we turn to medical care to solve a lot of social problems, and that's really the tail wagging the dog. 16. Eliminating co-payments doubles psychologist visits and decreases suicide in young adults. So, within our healthcare, money does matter, or in fact, access without barriers of payment vastly can change the outcomes in healthcare and the use of needed services. 17. With a promising new plan to pay for pricey cures, two states set out to eliminate hepatitis C, but cost hasn't been the biggest problem. So here, of course, is a limitation. Money can't be your only solution. So, for instance, we learned in COVID, you could have millions and millions and millions and millions of vaccine doses available, but if you don't get them in people's arms, they're not going to do any good. And the hepatitis C cure is actually very effective, but also very expensive. And while it's gotten cheaper, those places that have reduced the cost barriers still find that getting treatment to people with hepatitis C is a difficult thing to do, and points to the larger expansions we need in investment in public health infrastructure to reach, quote, hard to reach populations. And lastly, Article 17, an article you may be able to use yourself. Daily breath training can work as well as medicine to reduce high blood pressure. So there's a device that can actually help you have like a artificially make labored breathing, so you're exercising your lungs basically, and this can help. So a relatively low-tech way to exercise your lungs and improve your blood pressure. Well, these and other articles can be accessed on the web by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London, and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.